Hi, I'm John Porteous for the Lovells Township Historical Society, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Sorry we were offline last week, a couple of technical bumps, but we're back. And this week, Richard and I are going to sit down with one of our unsung heroes of the Asauville and fellow board member, Steve Johnson. Steve's really a Renaissance guy. He's he and his family both have a heck of a lot of experience here in the Lovells area. Rather than me set it up, I'm just going to let Steve talk. He's a lot more interesting than me. So without further ado, here we go. Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm half awake, as usual.
Good. Well, we prodded you out of bed, at an unreasonable hour today, so I appreciate you coming in and having some coffee with Richard and I. And
like me, you have to get up at the crack of 9 o'clock. It's a burden.
Exactly. Don't want the day to slip away too far.
I slept in today and got up at 6.
There you go. Good man. Good man. Yeah. I tried. Didn't work. Welcome. Listeners, Steve Johnson is a fellow board member of the Lovells Township Historical Society, but golly, he's all that and a heck of a bunch more. Rather than me yammer about it, Steve, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you came up, and we'll just kind of let things go.
All right. Well, my family's been here quite a while.
And quite a while is quite a while.
Yeah. My grandfather worked for the Douglases at the shingle mill as a teenager. My great-grandfather, who was William Bill, was a detective on the Detroit Police Force.
Oh, wow.
He was the original person to buy the buy property up here around 1904. It was a family deal.
Okay.
Everybody got a little bit of the Section 3 square mile.
Okay.
And
folks, that's a square mile of property owned. That's granted 1904, but
a
still.
Lot of Jack Pine and sand, yeah.
Yeah, Jack Pine and sand. And
Big Creek, too, though.
Yeah, Big Creek ran down through the middle of it, so it wasn't all dry.
Yeah.
They would drive up here from Detroit.
How long would that take?
Usually a day and a half to get up here. In the Fords of the day, Model T's.
That had to be, we jump in our cars and we moan and groan about getting stuck for 4 or 5 minutes in a construction area, and it's a little bit different.
Yeah, I got a Ford. I can make it up here in 6 or 12, or only a day and a half, maybe.
They may have originally started coming up here by rail, but I don't know for sure.
Would they have come to the rail stop in Grayling?
To the rail stop in Grayling, and what would take place would be you'd hire a a wagon to take you to your property. My grandfather was one of those, along with Clarence Stillwagon, that drove those wagons. That's how my grandpa met Henry Ford, driving the wagon to his property.
Okay. Now, we hear Henry Ford and others associated with various tracts of property. Which one was this?
This would be Dam 4.
Okay. So the didn't have another name like the Asauville Fishing Club or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there's still, the foundation of the water wheel is still there.
Yep. Not in fragments of the dam, of course. Mm-hmm. But,
well, the grain building was the maintenance building and the caretaker's place.
Yeah, lot, yeah, and that's kind of on the footprint mm-hmm. of the building that's there now.
No, I think it was a lodge, separate that's burned down, right?
Yeah,
the lodge. I meant where the powerhouse was, is that more or less in the footprint of where, or is that the caretaker's property where the...
What I've been told is that green building that's there now was the caretaker's
okay.
property, okay. residence.
Well, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go sideways with that, but that's, you know, that's a good 22 miles, isn't it? From Grayling out to Big Creek?
Oh, no, it's 5 miles.
Oh, okay.
It's not okay. that big a trip. Okay. But on a horse and wagon, it took a little while.
Well, yeah.
Got a chance to talk to the people that were going into the wilderness.
Well, right. Well, did your family come up here in 1904? I confess I don't understand the recreational mindset that well. What was the purpose of the property for recreation and?
Yeah, recreation. There's no intent on farming it.
Okay.
It had been logged off. I have photographs of that shortly after that, where there's not a tree standing on the property. You can practically see the levels from where we were.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. And the photos in the museum, you know, some of the club at Dam 4 mm-hmm. and, you know, the lack of mm-hmm. foliage.
Yeah.
And the picture of looking down at the Douglas house,
mm-hmm.
Which would have been catty-cornered to the shingle mill. Wouldn't that? That sits on the...
Yeah.
Catty corner side of the river, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's on the other side of the river. It would have been on the,
it'd be the
west side of the bridge.
Yeah.
About where the bar is now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was down about where the new parking area.
Yeah, where the landing is.
Yeah, where the foundation, yeah. where the bridge goes, the mm-hmm. stuff's in the water there, that hole. Where the railroad bridge used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's another thing. Yeah, there was a spur coming out of Grayling, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was...
Came up to levels?
Originally, it was put in for hauling logs.
Okay.
And there were tracks everywhere up here. Rail bed continued on into Lewiston.
Okay.
And there were spurs off of that were used to load up logs.
Trip out to different places.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so your family's coming up, your mm-hmm. relatives in 1904.
Yep.
And they've got a huge chunk of property on Big Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to enjoy fishing and hunting and all that the scorched earth levels out at that point.
Yeah, I have... There was a building built on the property about 1911, maybe a little bit prior to that, that was used to live in.
Okay.
I presume they lived in tents before that when they came up here.
Okay. And those would be nice sailcloth, big cotton,
mm-hmm.
heavy water-soaking tents as opposed
yeah.
to...
and
North Face in those days.
Yeah, anything North Face or Patagonia mm-hmm. related, yeah.
Yeah, I've got some photographs of large piles of rough grouse and snowshoe hares sitting around during hunting season.
I bet.
There were, after it was cut off, the deer population exploded, so there were a lot of... deer that were shot about that in that area.
Okay.
The bucks, eh?
One of the up until the last couple of years, we've had a hunting camp on the property since 1910, 1911.
That's awesome.
What, the old cabin was up till what, 4 years ago.
That was the cabin that was in the photograph in 1911.
So that's the one. Did it go up as a two-story cabin, or did it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It was a house building B. Everybody from the area came in, and it was put up in one day.
Okay, so like a barn raising.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We got some pretty good mileage out of that cabin, because I know people stayed in it almost to the end, right?
Yeah.
I was over there with Skip one time. We leaned against it, and it moved, but I guess the top floor was off limits.
Yeah.
You got a lot of mileage out of it.
Yeah, my cousin took it down a couple of years ago. He owns it now, and the bottom logs had just gone to pieces. It was too expensive to raise the building and put new logs in.
Yeah. Well, so in today's state, is your family kind of patchworked within that original square mile?
My one cousin who lives over in Hale owns about 600 acres. My sister owns 250 acres. My sister owns 120, and I own 120.
Okay.
That's what's left.
That's, well, nothing to sneeze at.
Mm-hmm.
During our coffee conversations over the years, it sounds like a pretty cool place.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a pretty cool place. You're having still all kinds of wildlife and fun and about. Now, the place you live in now, you and your wife built, didn't you?
Yeah, we started in the woods. I started with a chainsaw and cut trees and had them taken to the mill and in grailing. Made a lot of it's made out of rough cut lumber.
Okay, would that have been DuBois or?
No, that was Stampfly sawmill.
Okay. Okay.
John Stampfly.
All right.
He was a feisty character.
I'll tell you, the community has no shortage of colorful characters that way. Yeah.
Living up here in the old days probably was incentive to be feisty. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, maybe so.
Before the internet and telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but I want to talk a little more about you, but I'm mm-hmm. kind of fascinated about any recollections of family lifestyle in those early years up here.
Oh, well, really most of the lifestyle was centered around cars. People did drive up here in the open-top cars, even in the winter.
Okay.
I've got pictures of some old Cadillacs with their top downs and people all bundled up with snow flying.
I was going to say, back in the day, we got a lot of snow up here.
Yeah.
It'd be very interesting. Did one of the passengers have to bail snow while they were traveling? Or?
I don't know, but it must have been an interesting trip up here.
No doubt.
In those conditions.
No doubt.
Well, this was the one time, Skip, I remember Skip telling me that he can remember when there was nothing into this area but sand trails and two tracks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was all two tracks. There's still remnants of one of the pair of two tracks, one for going south and one for going north.
There you go.
Kind of an early I-75.
Yeah. And my mother set the land speed record going to Grayling one time in a Model T. She made it in half an hour.
Wow.
On two tracks.
Whoa.
All the way there.
Well, that's not bad time today.
That's
under the conditions.
That's making some time.
Yeah, my mother was a speedy driver.
She was, well, just to go in that direction, she was kind of a tough lady. I mean, she was the deer camp lady. And
well, yeah, she was.
Fisher lady, fisher person.
The first week of deer season, women weren't allowed in deer camp. And the second week of the season, she would show up and ask if anybody wanted a deer, she'd get one for them.
Now that you boys have had your fun, you want to eat?
Yeah.
That's awesome. What did your folks do? I guess maybe back up.
My grandfather worked in the mill.
Okay.
At Douglas Mill as a teenager. He also worked in the woods. The only records I've found in the archives of the Douglas business is a whole month where he was not working. He was off doing something else. He was an entrepreneur, I guess you could say.
Okay.
He opened the first automotive repair shop in West Branch that was north of Saginaw.
Hmm. That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And I've got a photograph of that somewhere.
Then he do the Delco plants for the lot?
Yeah. One of his other businesses, he sold Delco generators to nearly everyone. Everyone has a square of cement somewhere on their property, if they've been here any time, that the generator was bolted to.
Well, now, you know, that's because there weren't any power lines, right?
Oh, yeah, no power lines at all.
That was your power.
Yeah.
Well, I've been told we didn't have, in Lovell's here, we didn't have common user phone service till the 60s. Is that your recollection?
Yeah, in fact, the Hook and Trigger Club was responsible for getting a phone line in here.
No kidding.
Yeah, and my grandfather was one of the organizers that helped bring the phone line in.
That come up from Grayling or down from Lewiston? Or?
No, it was a commercial line that came out this way primarily for operations in the woods.
Okay. And well, there were other pocket communities that are no more that were active at that, like Judges or stuff like that?
Reno?
Well, this was in the 50s.
Oh, okay. No, all right.
Early 50s. Around 1950 was the time when the phone line was brought in.
We've got phone lines in the 50s and everything. And gone to hell since then.
There was a single phone at what is now the Kellogg store.
Okay.
For the entire Lovell's area.
Okay.
Now, we had a private phone line hooked up to the buildings, this is in the 50s, that ran from my mother's and dad's cabin to my grandfather's cabin and over to Louie's, so we could call one another on crank phones.
You just crank the line up.
So your own common battery setup.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. Well, you spent a lot of summers up here.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through some of it. I mean,
eventually my grandfather and Louie Bill got into a business together for distributing oil in the state of Michigan.
Okay.
Valvoline. And it was based in Saginaw. They had a big warehouse down there where they stored. But during the summer, my grandfather and grandmother would move up here, and he would be the contact person for all the
just kind of touch base with
customers
everybody
that we'd have in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula.
Okay.
Even crossed over into the UP. Eventually there was a bridge, but before that we couldn't deliver up there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, some of the photographs of staging for deer season for people to mm-hmm. ferry on across up into the UP are pretty dramatic.
Mm-hmm. But he would, along with my grandmother, they would come up and early in the spring all the way into through deer season, they would stay at the their place up here, which was built in 1935.
Okay.
And I would come up and, with my sister, and we would stay with them for the summer. And when it got time to go back to school, back to Saginaw we would go.
Well, was it pretty much a free-range youth for you then? Were you just pretty much allowed to go out and discover and explore?
Yep. I was told to go out in the woods and behave myself.
Take a cookie and get out of here.
Yeah.
I would, sometimes I'd ride with my grandfather around the northern parts of Michigan.
Okay.
Listening to all the stories he would tell people. And other times I would have to make do with whatever I could figure out, because there was nobody else where we were out there.
Well, it's not like you could run across the street and play with a pal.
Mm-hmm. We had visitors and they had kids, and I would see other kids, but for the most part I was by myself or with my, you know, sister and myself.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, talk a little bit about fly fishing through your youth. That had to be a blast.
I can't remember the first time I was fly fishing. I have a photograph of me at 5 years old with standing in the river with my cowboy hat on with a fly rod in my hand.
There we go.
With a fish.
See?
So I've been fishing since I can remember, fly fishing. My grandfather was a fly fisherman. My mother was an excellent fly caster.
Well, your mother was kind of an all-around sport, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was not...
Yeah, she hunted, she fished. Probably better than most.
Well, you know, be it as it may, I mean, I'm not ashamed to say it. I think virtually every woman I've ever seen cast fly line cast better than me.
Yeah.
You know, they just have that.
Yeah, when she was in high school, she was valedictorian of a fairly large high school.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, I went to the same school, and it was a very big disappointment.
You were not the valedictorian?
No.
I remember your mom. You should be more like her.
Yes, yeah. I had several teachers that taught my mother. And that was what they said.
Yeah, well, sometimes those shoes are hard to fit into. Mm-hmm. The,
Well, actually, you had a pair of her boots over at the museum 1 year, and I know you couldn't fit into them.
There you go. What, I guess let's back up and talk a little bit about your evolution outside of your exposure here.
Mm-hmm.
You, school-wise, you were in the Thumb, right, in Saginaw?
Yeah, high school, I went to Arthur Hill High School in Saginaw.
Okay.
It's on the west side of Saginaw.
Okay. And then and matriculated?
Yeah, I went, I was thrown out of high school and had to do something. So I went to Michigan Tech and studied chemistry.
And they play a little hockey in there every once in a while, maybe?
Yeah, you could say so.
Okay.
I was a walk-on on a hockey team. Didn't make the team. Because what turned out later on, one was first team All-American and the other guy was second team All-American in their senior year.
You know, there may have been a shortage of phone line, but there never seems to be a shortage of hockey players up here.
Well, no. I didn't play for Michigan Tech, but I played intramural.
There you go.
I was the only American on the team. Everybody else was a Canadian.
Isn't that fun?
out of the 4 years I played up there, we took the intramural championship 4 years.
There you go. There you go.
Had two guys on that team. when they graduated with their mining engineering degrees, played pro hockey.
There you go. Well, I had some to fall back on.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was their intent to begin with. They just wanted the engineering degrees.
Well, you yourself came away with an engineering degree. Is it in chemistry?
No, that's straight chemistry, bachelor of science.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I have started numerous master's degree programs, and I was more interested in the information than the piece of paper, so I never
gotcha.
Got a piece of paper.
Gotcha. Well, you had a pretty really successful career, and you've been able to see a lot of things and do a lot of things.
Yeah, worked 41 years in the automotive industry and automotive research. Primarily automotive braking systems, which might seem like a strange place for a chemist.
There's some hydraulics involved, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a lot of corrosion mechanisms that need to be solved. There are physical properties of fluids that need to be identified. There's just all manner of different things.
Did you invent the soap that you get the brake dust off your wheels?
Nope.
I didn't do that?
Nope.
Okay.
I only got two patents. One for a coolant treatment system to keep bacteria down. And what was the other one? Oh, yeah. Solid phase heat exchanger.
Oh, there you go.
For grinding operations, high-speed grinding operations.
Hmm. Like the cool blocks on bandsaws, the same type of thing?
No, it's a phase change. I would impregnate vitreous bonded grinding wheels with a material that would change phase and suck up all the heat.
I'm sitting here nodding my head like I understand, but I got no idea what the hell you're talking about.
Well, I did it for grinding helicopter. This is during the Vietnam era.
Oh, okay.
We were building a lot of helicopters, and they'd have these large castings for the transmission housings that they would grind gears in. It was a really slow process. This doubled the metal removal rate.
Wow.
That's awesome. So just thermal properties of different metal or
No.
Liquid?
There's a lot of heat generated at the grinding interface.
Mm-hmm.
That
friction.
coolant can't get into that interface well enough to remove the heat. So if the heat gets too high, you get a phase change in the casting that makes it brittle.
Right.
In other words, burning the metal.
Right.
So we were able to increase the metal removal rate by a factor of two.
Okay.
And without burning. So the heat was going into the phase change in the material that was in the grinding wheel.
Okay.
And it was carried out that way.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Good for you, man.
That's a lot of science.
Yeah. Okay, I think everybody's head's going to explode now. Maybe we ought to shift back to the woods. Yeah.
But that's how a chemist gets involved in.
Oh, for sure.
Largely a mechanical engineering business.
And you kept at it for, as you said, 41 years. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Nothing to sneeze at. Yeah.
Well, you were part of the ABS thing too, right?
Yeah. I was in at the, my first experience was on the ABS system. It was introduced on the Lincoln Continental in 1968.
I would say in that mm-hmm. in that area for sure, because I know just because of my dad's work, GM was doing some stuff
mm-hmm.
with that, and somehow he ended up with a really weird-looking Buick Apollo that had a pilot ABS system in it. And it was maybe a year, year and a half after that. So, pretty cool stuff, man.
Yeah, went from braking to stability control systems.
Is that sway?
It allows the driver to drive up to the limits of physics.
Okay.
And feel comfortable about doing it.
Okay.
Not
mechanical grip then? Or?
Well, it has a lot to do with braking individual wheels.
Okay.
To keep the vehicle in a stable condition.
Okay.
In cornering and that sort of thing.
So the left might not need as much braking as the right, or vice versa, or front to rear.
Yeah, it was all the brakings are digital systems. They're not pressure modulated. They're on-off systems.
Okay.
So if you get the on-off rate high enough, like 60 cycles, yeah, you can do some pretty interesting things with that.
So the brakes on my pickup are centered on it. They looked at a microchip from someplace.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Better hope it's a friendly.
Yeah. Give me a rope and a brick to throw out the window.
Well.
Yeah, that's how I got to go to MIT for a crash course.
Wow.
In micro machining technology.
Wow.
We got there were about 30 people in this course. It was a 1 week of information that MIT would normally put out in a year.
Okay.
And you got 12 hours of classwork a day and 10 hours of homework a night.
And so you got 2 hours of sleep. Wake up and come sharp.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely boot camp that way.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
But that was really cool. Got to meet a lot of the people at the cutting edge of the technology.
I should think. Well, it's kind of a really cool, innovative era too, through the 60s and 70s. There's a lot changing. Safety-wise, I guess, simple things like seat belts and, crash bars and doors.
We made those too.
Yeah. Good stuff. Well, so did, when you're not pounding out boot camps at MIT or long hours at work, are you sneaking up here to the woods to chill?
Well, yeah. As was mentioned earlier, we live at a place that my wife and I built. So it was about 30 years of weekends building the place. Unusual construction in that it's post and beam construction, but not solid beams. They're all laminated with the rough cut lumber glued, laminated, and nailed together. A lot of it done up in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a full two-story building.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I learned how to use an adze. And I especially learned how to be careful with an adze because the one I had was razor sharp. And I took a swing one time and cut the toe of my boot open all the way to my toes. Never
oh,
touched
boy.
My toes.
Oh, boy. Wow. Yeah.
And, I didn't put the foundation in. That was something that was, I had done, but everything else is my own labor.
That is pretty cool. I don't know that qualifies as relaxation for everybody's vision, but regardless, it is pretty cool, and it's a beautiful place.
Yeah, I did have trout fishing to ease my pain during the evening.
Well, good. you weren't totally slaving all the time.
No.
Okay. Good. Well, and you know, hour or two on the stream can be quite therapeutic during those working years.
Then in the fall, of course, chased birds, and when it got to be November time, we chased deer.
There you go. Well, I mean, that it's like a state holiday up here. In that regard, in having had been blessed with the opportunity to be exposed to the area over that long a time period, it's easy to call out, oh yeah, not as many birds, not as many fish, yada yada yada. But
well, there's certainly more trees.
There we go. Well, here and there.
Yeah, here and there.
Here and there, they're trying to get rid of some more. But growing up, you were experimenting with river structure, weren't you?
Yeah. In fact, I have lost it now, but I had a notebook with different designs that I'd put in the river, tracking how long they would last, because Big Creek is kind of flashy in the spring. You get a big chunk of water coming down, and it would take out a lot of woody structure.
Sure.
So I was interested in seeing how I could build things that would stick around longer.
Okay.
So I finally came up with one design that was essentially anchored into and up on the bank, triangular structure.
Okay.
That I'd fill in the interior of the triangular structure, and it had one single post at the apex of one of the triangles. Wasn't anchored to that post, but it ride up and down on it and keep the structure somewhat stable.
Semi-static.
And the last one of those I built was around 1970, and it just washed out this last spring.
I was going to say, it's been around for a bit. <Yeah. laughs> That's pretty cool. That's pretty very cool. That led to, all along the way, too, you've had a TU presence. Nope, sorry about that. Little tech glitch there. Go ahead, Steve. Okay. Tell us about your TU experiences.
Yeah, I grew up in Saginaw when I wasn't up north. And, of course, if you grew up in Saginaw, you ran into Art Newman. If you were a fly fisherman, you'd go to his shop and buy stuff. At that point, I really wasn't involved in TU, didn't know much about it. But then when I went off to college, one of my professors who got there about the time I was leaving, Terry Warrington, was initial in starting the UP chapter of Trout Unlimited.
Biology professor?
Chemistry,
okay.
So I was leaving, and he was starting the thing up, and I got downstate here and realized that it was a heck of a drive to come down to the Michigan TU meeting. So, hey, Terry, I'll be representative for the UP chapter if you keep me filled in.
There you go.
So I did that for a while. And then another one of my friends, Terry Nabb, was instrumental in TU in the UP when he lived in Marquette after he graduated from Michigan Tech. He also knew Terry and fished with him, Terry Warrington.
We love Terry.
So I did that for a number of years, working with the TU chapter in the UP. Eventually, since I was living in Ann Arbor, I was a member of both the Jackson chapter of TU and the Ann Arbor chapter for a long time.
Okay.
Just a member, nothing more. But when I moved up here, I became involved in the Mason Griffith chapter, where I was on the was and still am on the board.
I was going to say, you still are, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Lots to talk about there too. But let's touch on Jerry and river mapping and some of your influences in that space.
Yeah. I met Jerry on the river.
We miss Jerry too.
Yeah. I met Jerry on the river. He was had his barge there with ropes strung all across the river and up and down it. And I inquired as to just what the heck he was doing. He says, "I'm mapping the river." Oh. And I got to learn more about that. So it was easy to talk to Jerry because he did all the talking.
Yeah.
for those of you who don't know nothing, that we're talking about Jerry Lake now.
Yeah, another river evangelist. But yeah, I love him.
Yeah.
It was about a 20-minute hello with Jerry.
Yeah. he described to me what he was doing, and I said, "I think there's a better way of doing it." And that's with a GPS unit. He says, "Well, I've got some GPS units, but I'm not using them to map the river." So we figured out a way to do river mapping using the GPS units. And now we've got all these GPS coordinates. What are we going to do with them? So I said, we need a map, need an electronic mapping program. So I researched that, and I had a friend who was a cartographer over in Traverse City. He said, "Well, what you need is this piece of software." We've been using that ever since. Take the GPS coordinates, throw them into the software, connect the dots, and you got yourself a map.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Was there delineation between shorelines? Would you go to one side of the river and take a coordinate, and Jerry go to the opposing side of the river and take a coordinate?
We developed a procedure
so
to
you
use.
Get, you know, river welts and
yeah.
Such.
It was pretty obvious once you got the GPS coordinates down which bank was which.
Gotcha. Okay.
We measure about 20 feet apart for GPS marking.
Okay.
And the first maps were not only riverbanks, but we're mapping various different substrate areas in the river.
Okay.
We're marking woody structure.
There we go.
Artificial and natural. Bank cover vegetation.
Okay.
Vegetation in the river, in the water. So they were fairly complex maps.
Sounds awesome.
This is ongoing?
It's kind of died out. Mostly what I use mapping now is
that ArcGIS stuff?
Yeah, red mapping on the river.
Sure. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
And I use, digital USGS maps and just put dots on to locate. USGS, I found that USGS maps are nice, but they're not all that accurate.
Okay. Are they ever evolving as well? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've had several iterations of maps come through. All USGS maps are free to download, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to keep up to date. Some of the things that have been added lately are satellite imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps quite a bit. I've been moving more towards satellite imagery than hand-drawn maps or digital maps because they represent the neighborhood better.
Well, exactly. It offers context to the river itself, and it helps mm-hmm. to explain the drainage and the environment within that drainage.
I can tell when the map was made by looking at what car was parked in the garage, in the driveway. Right there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. My garage still doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so it goes.
But there's some really high-resolution imagery out there that tells you a lot more than Google.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But it costs money.
Yeah, well, it does. It does. But it's still, you know, knowledge has value. And mm-hmm. In that instance, you know, for the work that we're trying to get done,
yeah.
Good info. Good info. What and you know, river map, red. Hello, red mapping is still a thing. That's a
oh yeah,
still a fall tradition. And
yeah, I've even the DNR has taken up doing some of it. Although I think they've probably done as much as they're going to.
Yeah, well, they're a little hamstrung with resources, yeah. But
I've done maps for them on the sturgeon, the pigeon.
Oh, wow.
And a couple of tributaries of the sturgeon. I've done maps on the south branch for Mason Griffith, on the north branch for the anglers, and on the mainstream for Mason Griffith.
Wow. Very cool.
So there's a lot to be done there. But it's getting to be a task.
Well, you know, there's
everything is
yeah. Everything. But yeah, there's I know there's Mason Griffith has a laundry list of projects going this summer. You want to highlight a few? This is listeners. I'll tell you what. If you're up here and you want to, you know, give back to the river, if you live here and you want to have a fun morning. It's generally, what, a 4 or 5 hour activity to volunteer? And
yeah.
Hell, I think you guys feed yeah. people after it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, what are the projects this year?
And I apologize because I didn't do my due diligence. I should know them. Well, it just got me thinking about the red project, yeah. And there's always a laundry list of more.
Yeah, I've gone totally blank here.
No, well, let's see. Well, I think we got some work with the East Branch Reconnect. I think we've got some upper Manistee works, maybe some habitat work up there.
Yeah, I think they're doing something around Pollock. Okay. Bridge, reworking the structures that were put in several years
Something
ago.
Something like that. There's a lot of reevaluation.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of electroshocking that's going to be done this
year.
Well,
this is exciting. This is super exciting.
Yeah, something that I've...
Somebody did this chapter a pretty big yeah. solid there, I think.
Yeah. It's something that is needed to validate what's being done in the river.
Right.
Because up until now, it is, let's put in this junk and see what happens.
Right.
And then never looking to see what happens.
And never taking an after measure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so let's...
Done everything you can do from Lansing.
Yeah. In that regard, let's talk about the shocking thing for a little bit. Because, you know, and this is not to impugn anyone, but... There are gaps in the data, historical data, and a lot of that revolves around state funding for such activities. Now,
I'm not so sure it's state funding.
Okay.
There are regular intervals between when they are doing the. The shocking studies. It takes 5 or 6 people to run a shocking program.
Right.
And it's time consuming. And the DNR doesn't have the people it had one time.
Well, exactly. That's kind of what I was getting at. Mm-hmm. I don't want to... It's real easy to throw the DNR under the bus for a lot mm-hmm. of stuff, and sometimes right, sometimes wrong.
Too
but,
easy.
Yeah, so we're not going to hit that pinata too hard. But there are, if you look back through the historical data, like at Eamons, there are just years they just didn't do it. Because I think, to your point, they just didn't, couldn't. Yes?
Well, you look at the data trends, and there is a point where there's diminishing return. However, what you do when you stop a program at a particular location, you miss remarkable transitions.
Exactly.
And whether they're good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And while it would be very useful to have that information, again, there is a limit as to what people can do. And the field staff in the DNR has been reduced considerably over time.
Now, this has kind of opened the door, though, for organizations like Mason Griffith, Anglers, and others to acquire privately funded.
It's interesting that I mentioned Art Newman before. Uh-huh. He did not want Trout Unlimited involved in restoration projects.
Really?
He wanted that to be done by the DNR.
Okay.
And he was adamant about it.
And I can appreciate that, but that's a while in the rearview mirror, yeah, too.
Allegedly, the stewards of the natural resources would seem to fall into their...
Under their purview, yeah.
So there's been a big change in attitude over time at TU about river work.
Putting actual boots in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, I think they stepped into a void, and they're probably considering this. Under the circumstances, it's probably a good thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can stand idle and say, well, this entity should be doing it, or... You can jump in and fill a void and make stuff happen. Yeah.
Yeah. His approach was more political than what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, involved.
Yeah.
Involved in doing the actual work.
Okay.
Anglers of the Ensemble is heavily involved in the political aspects of trout management. However, they're also doing stream work, as is witnessed by what's going in the North Branch.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but they pledged $500,000 or some wild amount over 10 years. Not insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so I guess we kind of went down a long alley there, but circle back. There are a lot of volunteer opportunities for projects that the Mason Griffith chapter is sponsoring and leading. Those are posted on the Mason Griffith TU website.
Yep.
And I encourage you all to go out and take a look, and it really is. It's a fun way to, you don't have to do them all, but if you try it out, do one, meet some folks, have some fun, put something forward to the river, and all it costs is a few hours of your time. And as I said, I think you guys actually feed people at the end of it.
Yeah, there are three organizations that do things for the North Branch. One is Mason Griffith. They work at the extreme ends of the river, West Branch of Big Creek tributaries. There's anglers who do a lot of those structure work in the river itself. And then there's the North Branch Foundation that supports a lot of these activities with dollars and in some cases effort.
Yep.
So there are three...
It is actually older than either of those organizations you mentioned previous.
It is. It was started in the 40s. By several members were from head places on the North Branch. And they got together and formed this organization.
It's pretty cool, and they're doing good work to this day.
Yeah, yeah, it's
got the targeting what, the Purple Loosestrife campaign later this summer.
Purple Loosestrife have
signage promoting.
Mm-hmm. Signage promoting, keeping the river open,
river etiquette.
They have actually have people that float the river to look for problems.
Sure. I mean, it's pretty cool. The North Branch Foundation budgets and funds beaver trapping, mm-hmm. where that becomes problematic for the river's health. In the event that some type of obstruction appears into the river, typically deadfall, they budget and fund mm-hmm. basically tree removal from the river. If it's blocking egress. But pretty cool group. And one that, interestingly enough, you sit on the board of. We see a trend line here, Steve. You got your fingers in a lot of areas doing a lot of good.
Yeah, you sometimes wonder what exactly it is I'm doing.
Yeah, well, a bunch. And I guess we'll wrap it up. I just say thank you. Thank you for all the work you do. Thank you for all the work you've done. And thanks for sitting down with us and sharing a cup of coffee this morning.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Continue to go out and do good things. Until then, listeners, we'll see you next week.
Steve is a fun guy, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. We certainly enjoyed bringing it to you. As a reminder, on the 24th of June, if you're in the area, Nancy will be conducting a dedication ceremony for the new gardens. So definitely would encourage you to stop by and enjoy the handiwork as we've done a refresh and learn about the nice backstory on those two gardens. So for now, that's it. We'll see you next week. And until then, mind your backcast.